I'll call a meeting of the March 5th, 2025 meeting of the House Public Safety Committee to order. A quorum is present. If we do not complete our work today by committee's 4:45 adjournment time, we recess and reconvene in room 123 at 6:30 p.m. or at the call of the chair. I believe both caucuses will have meetings. Before our meeting, I want to remind everyone that the committee expects proper decorum at all times. All dialogue goes through the chair. Signs are not allowed in the committee room. There will be no outburst or clapping. There is no standing or sitting in walkways and aisles. If accommodation is needed, communicate with the sergeant staff. There will be consequences if there is a disruption. Thank you to the sergeant at arms staff who are present for helping to maintain decorum in the committee room. Representative Bliss, have you had a chance to review the minutes of the March 4th, 2025 meeting?
I have, Mr. Chair, and I move for their adoption.
Does anyone else have corrections for the minutes? Representative Bliss moves the approval of the March 4th, 2025 minutes. All in favor say aye.
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 All opposed nay. Motion carries, and the minutes of the March 4th, 2025 meetings are approved. I'd like to thank Ken Savaray from House Finance for filling in for John Walsh on this meeting. He couldn't be here, so thank you for filling in. The first bill on the agenda is House File 767. Representative Hudson, please come to the testifier tables with your testifiers. Since you are a member of the committee, would you like to move House File 767 before the committee?
That is my motion, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hudson, we haven't received a fiscal note on this bill yet, so we will be laying it over. Please begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 767 would enhance penalties for arson when it is targeted against a political organization or motivated by a political purpose. It establishes the crime of arson in the first degree if a person destroys or damages any building through the use of fire explosives, and the building is housed in a political organization, or the offense was committed in whole or substantial part because of an association between a political organization and the building, or if the offense was committed in whole or substantial part to make a political statement. This is a bill in response to an incident which took place last January that you have reference to in an article from the Minnesota Star Tribune in your packets, where the building where the Center of the American Experiment, Take Charge, and the Upper Midwest Law Center were housed at that time. It's my understanding that each of those organizations were very clearly specifically targeted. The fires were started outside the doors to their offices, so it was very clearly a targeted attack. There's another bill that I'll be presenting here later that speaks to the fact that this suspect or suspects, whoever they were, have yet to be identified and remain at large. In the political environment that we find ourselves in, where we're increasingly polarized and the temperature keeps rising in terms of what people feel is at stake in our political process here in this building and in Washington, D.C., making sure that we draw a clear line as to how far you can take your protest and dissent, I think is something that should be a priority for this committee and this House. That is my bill, Mr. Chair, and I believe my first testifier is Kendall Qualls from Take Charge. I would invite him to come to the table now.
Mr. Qualls, could you state your full name and begin your testimony?
Sure, Kendall Qualls, resident in Medina. Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Hudson, for the invitation. I founded an organization 5 years ago that promotes that the promise of America is available to everyone, regardless of race, regardless of social station. It's a message that conflicts with the prevailing narrative in our media, academia, with the Democratic Party, definitely here in Minnesota. But despite having a tight grip on virtually all news outlets, the governor's seat, the state house, the House of Legislature, it seems progressives cannot have one dissenting voice in our state. So in the dead of night, my office was firebombed along with two other conservative organizations in the same three-story office building that not only vacated our offices, but 20 other private businesses. And those other organizations, the Center for American Experiment and the Upper Midwest Law Center. So I hope the Democrats on this committee vote in favor of this bill. I strongly suspect they won't, but I hope they do. But just know this, by voting against this bill, you're supporting midnight riders that firebombed a black-owned business. Let me just make sure I make this clear. In the Democratic Party, my parents lived through the Jim Crow South. They were firebombed in the dead of night by the historical roots of the Democratic Party of the KKK. This is what you're going to be supporting if you don't support this. Let me just make a point of record here as well. 12 months after that firebomb, I got contacted personally by the Alliance for a Better Minnesota, the largest multi-million dollar fund here in the state that funds the Democratic Party in this state, second only to the teachers union. So I have been targeted to be silenced, firebombed once, directly contacted by an opposition party or opposition organization, secondly.
Mr. Qualls, please keep it to the bill.
And I won't be silenced. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Your next testifier is Mr. Walsh. Please state your full name and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bill Walsh, Senator of the American Experiment. I'm the Director of Marketing and Communications. So let me just help paint a picture of what happened in this arson, like you said, a year ago. Just for way of, if those who don't know, Center of the American Experiment is Minnesota's think tank. We're a public policy organization. You know, we write and research about state issues, education, public safety for this committee, you know, energy, the state budget, taxes, regulations, things like that. So a year ago, I got a call from a colleague that said, did you hear about the fire in our building? And when you hear fire in your building, you think, oh, somebody burned popcorn in the microwave and there's some smoke damage. And that's honestly what I thought. No, it was an arson. So, oh, come on, an arson. No, it was overnight, Saturday night into Sunday, you know. It just keeps escalating as you keep talking about it, and it starts to sink in. Somebody set a fire in our office building to try and burn us down, to try and silence us. And just kind of keeps escalating. When you go visit, it didn't really hit until you walk in, you see the hallway, it's just completely black and charred. And you go upstairs, Upper Midwest Law Center, their office, their complete office was gutted. Luckily, the fire didn't make it through the door, but all the smoke damage and water damage, of course, ruined everything. And then it just keeps escalating. The FBI is involved. The ATF is involved. They're saying right away, yep, this is arson. This is a professional job. What does that mean? There's professionals that do this. These people that do it more than once. You know, no cell phones used when they broke in. No car to drive up. They couldn't find any evidence. These guys were real professionals. And arson is a difficult crime to solve. A lot of the evidence burns. So here we are a year later with no really good leads. You know, it's this chilling feeling comes over you. And, you know, they're trying to chill our speech. You know, we're charts and graphs. We write about, like I said, we're like solar and wind aren't the answer. We like school choice, you know, state budget cuts. You know, and someone tried to stop us from speaking on those views. Now, it didn't work for us. I mean, we didn't miss a beat. We don't have a product to sell. We don't have a retail location. We deal in intellectual property. We all took our laptops home, and we just kept working. We're out of that facility indefinitely. Luckily, our landlord, you know, found us another place to move into. We have good insurance. We have a healthy bank account. Like I said, because we deal in intellectual property, we didn't really miss a beat. We kept writing. We kept publishing. We kept coming down here to testify. Our magazine kept coming out every quarter. But that's lucky for us. I mean, other businesses, you look at, you know, businesses from the riots in 2020 that were burned down, arsoned, those were retail locations. They lost everything, including a customer base and ability to do business. So I think I agree. Representative Hudson said it's a toxic environment. And it's kind of sad that a bill like this would be necessary. to increase penalties for motivation behind a crime like arson. There's already, arson's already a crime, right? I'm here to tell you it for a moment it can have that real chilling effect on us. And luckily, we're going to continue on, keep doing what we're doing, but others may not be so lucky. So thank you.
Thank you. Are there any member questions for Representative Hudson or his testifiers? Pinto, Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Hudson. I guess I do want to note at the start, and Chair, I appreciated you, the comment about keeping things on track, but I guess I was concerned. I do want to recognize if the intent is to keep the temperature down, that just we do need to be careful with comments. And again, Chair, I appreciated what you were saying, but just a reminder that as folks are being called out by certain political parties, et cetera, even before we've had a discussion on the bill, I guess I resent that. So I'll just pause with that. So a couple questions, Representative Hudson. So one is, I had recalled you in the past, both in conversations and committee and in floor votes, as expressing a lot of concern about punishing crimes based on motivation. And I probably should say just at the start, obviously arson in any situation is unacceptable, any building is unacceptable, and certainly when it is motivated and by politics, that's extremely concerning, right? So absolutely. But I do recall you talking about the danger of setting punishment based on motivation and based on thoughts. I mean, specifically, I've got language from a floor speech that you gave when there was a last term. Anyway, I'm just wondering, how do you square that with your support for this bill? How do we think about that?
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Pinto. I very much appreciate the question. I think there's a distinction to be made about, it's not as though motivation has no part to play in how we determine the degree of a crime or the extent to which it should be punished. I think the particulars of the type of motivation that we're talking about certainly ought to be taken into consideration. So I discern that you're making reference to the concept of hate crime, which is something that I find to be more oblique and less defined than what is presented in this bill. The motive of any crime is obviously malicious, and I think as a general rule, typically, we should treat crimes as being similar in nature, similarly malicious, similarly hateful, and shouldn't be looking for reasons to apply additional weight to one crime over another. In this case, what I would argue is that a politically motivated crime goes to a higher level simply because the intention is to disrupt our democracy, to disrupt our political discourse, to chill speech, to put people in a position where they feel as though it is quite literally unsafe for them to express themselves, unsafe to hold and express opinions about how their society ought to be operated and the rights that they ought to have and how those rights ought to be upheld. And I don't think it's healthy for our discourse. I don't think it's healthy for our discourse in rooms like this, in bodies like the Minnesota House of Representatives, and in the public generally, for us to foster environments or tolerate environments where people feel quite literally unsafe to say what they believe.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Hudson, I feel like the kind of motivations that were discussed in the bill last term about race and gender ethnicity, I think we need to recognize that those are in fact ways that people with those backgrounds are in fact end up being excluded from participation in our democracy. Like I think it's pretty clear that in fact there is a strong connection there. And I guess describing this as political motivation, I know that these are the phrases, but when I look at the way your bill is written, I don't think that this is actually how this works. And I think if we look at arson in the fifth degree, look down at the bottom of page 2 if you can. That may be the easiest thing to kind of take us out of the building context. If you set fire to a T-shirt that you own, why should that be punished greater if that T-shirt says Harris Walls and you want to make a statement about how you so strongly dislike Harris Walls, you buy that T-shirt, you set fire to that T-shirt. Why is that? Why are we going to punish that more? And in fact, let me add to this, how is that not a violation of the First Amendment? That is, you are, that's a, you're making, you are making, in fact, a political statement on lines 3.7, 3.8, and all throughout this. If you want to address both those points.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Pinto. Once again, I very much appreciate the nature of the question. And please follow up if I fail to answer both the points, because you know how this goes.
I will.
So the point about why you should be charged if you light a T-shirt, right, like the hypothetical situation. And actually, I think I could probably kill these two birds with one stone, right? So the act of lighting the shirt on fire, the act of setting a fire, is not itself speech, right? Like you are committing, you are endangering your neighbors, potentially creating a hazardous situation. That is an action, that is not an expression. And it's a well-worn concept in the law that just because you have the right to express yourself doesn't mean that you get to do it in any place, at any time, in any manner. Place, manner, and speech limitations are a well-worn, a well-established aspect of our law. And this also, and at the danger of getting outside the limits of my own bill, I just find the topic fascinating. There's this kind of fallacy that's perpetuated in our public discourse that if something is public, then you can do whatever you want with it. And that similar fallacy is also applied very commonly to the First Amendment and to free speech. Yes, you have the right to speak. Yes, you have the right to express yourself. That doesn't mean you can come into this committee with a bullhorn and get 2 feet from my face and scream at me. It doesn't mean you can light something on fire. It doesn't mean you can commit crimes.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Representative Hudson, thanks, but I think you were missing the point I'm making. So the question is not, is it okay to criminalize the burning of the T-shirt? The question is, why is it both appropriate and, frankly, consistent with the First Amendment to say you're going to have a higher penalty for burning a T-shirt by making a political statement? You're burning a T-shirt in order to express your political statement. That's going to be a higher penalty. If you just said burning the T-shirt and we're not going to look at the motivation, that's consistent with the First Amendment. That's consistent with the current law. But what you're trying to do here is say that if you are expressing, if you're using your First Amendment rights, we're going to punish you more than if you did the exact same action without making a political statement. And that, my friend, that is a violation of our First Amendment rights, I think quite clearly, just that clause. I got one other point that I'll make, but if you can respond to that.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you once again, Representative Pinto. I'm picking up what you're putting down. So I fundamentally disagree with you. And the reason why I fundamentally disagree with you is because the act of expressing yourself is not unlimited in terms of the impact of what the consequences of your expression is. So for example, if someone were to threaten you, that is not an exercise of the First Amendment right to free speech. You have crossed a line where you're actually endangering or threatening danger to the safety of another person. And so a crime, an underlying crime, that on top of it has the intention of sending the message that you are threatening people with whom you disagree deserves a higher level of scrutiny.
Mr. Representative Pinto.
Yeah, final comment, because I would turn to colleagues. So, Representative Hudson, so you've brought in a different concept, which is a threat. That's a different thing. And so what I'll just say is that each of your clause threes, I think, is clearly a violation of the First Amendment, because it's exact same behavior, doing the exact same behavior with the intent to make a political statement versus not make a political statement. Making political statements, if there's a threat, that's a different thing. Okay, so clause three is out because of that. And I'll just point out, I can see, and I wish you, it was more consistent with what you'd said last, I wish you'd flipped around last term and wish that the Representative Hudson of now had been talking to Representative Hudson from 2 years ago. Because I do think it makes sense, right, that if in fact there is this bias or something going on there, perhaps there's something that should be addressed. But that's not what the rest of your bill does as well. If in fact there is damage to a building that houses a political organization or damage to property, any of these other things, and there's not that motivation, let's say it's anything else, has nothing to do with political motivation, and yet that ends up getting a higher penalty. That's not consistent with anywhere else in our law as well. So I understand what you're trying to do here, and I could sort of possibly see some possible way, but the way this is written, it absolutely does not work. I've got a lot of concerns. Thanks.
Representative Hudson, you were a member of the committee last year when we passed the statute changes on co-defendants, and would it be possible that, as first of all, would you entertain a question about amending it to political property of another? But just as a thought before we bring it back, because we're going to lay it over, but do you think this is something that could be established with the same investigation where we decide how a co-conspirator is charged in a crime?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure I'm following the premise that you're offering. But what I will say is that I'm certainly open to trying to narrow the scope of the provision that Representative Pinto was talking about regarding the incidental arson targeting a building where a political organization happens to be housed. I do think that intention does matter in this case. And the other point that I would like to make in response to this vigorous back and forth that Representative Pinto and I have had is that I actually, ironically, think that this approach of targeting political intention, political motivation, actually does a better job of accomplishing what I perceive to be the intention of hate crime laws. So if somebody's engaged in a crime with the intention to threaten a people group or a population, that itself is a political motivation, right? So if we were to narrow the scope, instead of hate, which is this kind of ambiguous and subjective term, if we were to say, look, if what you're trying to do is chill people's speech, chill people's expression, chill how people present themselves in the world, I think that would do a better job of accomplishing what hate crimes have traditionally, in my perception, been intended to do.
Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Hudson. I am still parsing my way through this bill, I'll be honest. I'm trying to figure out where I am on it. But I do feel like I have to address, some things that your testifier said that I don't think were entirely fair. My dad is from Birmingham, Alabama. He lost his cousin in the 16th Street Baptist church bombings that happened. And that is horrible. And I do not appreciate it being brought up in the context of just talking about policy like you guys were just doing, right? I think there's a reasonable way to talk about this. There's an inflammatory way to talk about this. And that's my family's history. And so it hurts inside of me to have that brought up and used as saying that's a reason why we should be voting for it or against it, or that we would go one way or another on it. But I do have a technical question for you, in addition to all my feelings that I'm feeling right now. And my question is, when I look through this bill, it looks like it addresses first, third, fourth, and fifth degree arson, but not second degree. And I'm wondering if that was purposeful or an oversight.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Hollins. I am not certain whether or not your observation is correct, and if it is, then it would have been an oversight in my understanding.
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, members, arson in the second degree, which is 609-562, applies to buildings that are not covered under the arson in the first degree statute. Since the buildings would be covered now under the arson in the first degree statute under the bill, there would be no crime of second degree arson, because a building that, for example, houses a political organization would always be a first degree arson. There'd be no second degree arson for damage to such a building.
Okay. Representative Hollins.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair. First, I'll say I appreciate the acknowledgement here that speech, whether we agree it's called hate speech or something else, can lead to violent actions. I think that is a conversation that we've had in multiple committees on some disagreement of where that path leads to and what speech is allowable. I do think it's really easy for someone to sit here and say things like, it's just thought or it's just free speech. Well, then third parties hear those words, act upon them in a harmful manner, and say, well, They did something violent. All I did was say something on my mind. It's easy to hide behind that and claim zero responsibility and accountability for some increased hostility that we're seeing. And a lot of that is because of threats to safety that people are seeing incorporated into legislation that's being developed by half of this body. So I just need to put that out there that thoughts, speech, all of these things are also incorporated into legislation, not this legislation, but other legislation. And so we just need to be really careful when we're talking about protecting thoughts and protecting speech, especially in not conflating that things like gender identity, race, ethnicity, that's who someone is. Politics are what you choose to be. You can make decisions of whether or not you believe in someone's humanity or not, or whether, and we can have testifiers come up and say that they just write articles about charts and ed policy, but they also write articles about their representatives and how much they hate them because of their political party. So I just think, it's been mentioned here, we have testifiers who are maybe not doing you help in promoting this bill because there's a way that this could have been argued that really could have gotten me on board. And the approach used here, I don't want anybody setting things on fire for any reason. That's ridiculous. Like, that's not how you solve problems, clearly. But because of the way that this is presented and defended, I'm almost inclined to vote no just on principle because of how these issues are being discussed.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm reminded of the process that we went through last term to get both the Indian Family Preservation Act and the African American Family Preservation Act passed on the floor with, as I recall, unanimous votes. And it was not an easy process at all. And part of the reason why it wasn't an easy process is exactly the dynamic that you just described of people getting caught up in the rhetoric that one side or the other used in order to promote the policy rather than looking at the substance and the impact of the policy. I know that's hard. It's hard for me sometimes. It was hard for a lot of my members in our caucus on both of those bills to look past some of the comments that were being made publicly justifying why we should do these things. At the end of the day, it's my hope, and I think it's a reasonable and proper goal for us to look at what is the substance of the policy, what is the impact of the policy, and is that good or bad on its merits. Regarding the distinction that was made between innate characteristics, race, ethnicity, sex, and so forth, versus politics, and the distinction being that what you believe politically is a choice. Well, any given expression is a choice. Any given thing that you claim, that you believe, that you project, the way you express yourself, these things are choices. The question is, are we going to defend that freedom of conscience? Are we going to defend that freedom to choose how you express yourself? And again, I think it goes beyond the individual, and it is there is a strange harmony with the argument that has been made in the past regarding hate speech, or hate crimes in particular. The idea that if you commit a crime that has an impact beyond the individual victim, that is worthy of applying a higher degree of penalty. I'm taking the nut of that concept, and I'm applying it in a different way. A way that I believe is less subjective. When your intention in committing a crime is to chill somebody's speech, to chill somebody's expression, that is deserving of a higher level of penalty, in my opinion, and what I'm trying to convince folks of here today. And the last thing I would just like to say, I might have slipped my mind, but it might come back to me, and if it does, I'll mention it to you. Thank you.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that actually sort of picks up where I wanted to go, which is, can you define political? Like, what's in and what's out? I didn't see a definition in this bill.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Greenman. That's something I've been thinking about. in all honesty, is should there be a definition of political or political organization or political motive or any of the other terms that are in this bill? And I think where I'm landing, and I'm open to persuasion on this, is that it is best to leave that to the discretion of judges and juries in terms of prosecuting these crimes, and prosecutors in terms of their prosecutorial discretion, simply because I'm not sure. It's a crude analogy, but the thought that occurred to me when I was thinking through this is it's like that old quote about pornography. You know it when you see it, right? Like when somebody intentionally sets fire outside the offices of three political organizations, I know that was politically motivated. There's no ambiguity about that. And so I think giving prosecutors and judges and juries the latitude to be able to determine the degree to which something was politically motivated is the best approach. But again, I am open to persuasion on that point.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you. I guess my concern, and I think you used it as you were talking about hate, but is sort of the subjective nature of political. And I think like many of us would say in our lives, lots of things are political. And I think to start where I think my colleagues started, which is, arson is bad, and it is bad to target mosques and synagogues and churches and political organizations and schools and homes that have people in them. All of that is and our laws should reflect that. And what we're really talking about here is the motivation. We're talking about two things: the motivation of the person, and again, treating it as a more serious offense because of how they were motivated. But the other thing that this bill does and that concerned me is clause one, like 2.5, 2.17, actually it sort of does the opposite, which is it's sort of strict liability for a political organization. If you burn down a building and the building houses a political organization, which of amorphous, that you don't know it's in there, this, given that there's an or, would say that there's a increased penalty even without that motivation. So this bill seems to both add a penalty for more than the normal, more than a arson without the bill. It adds a penalty if you're motivated by bias. It also adds a penalty if you're not motivated by bias potentially, but just happened to burn or to arson, is that a verb? I'm not sure. To conduct arson on a building that has a political organization. And in that case, it feels like what political organization is really matters. Because if is a organization that supports or opposes charter schools a political organization? Is an organization that support or opposes food safety, I'm just sort of coming to the top of my head. If those are all political organizations, which I would argue they probably are, they're advocating for things, many of those are not going to be in a building with a name that anybody knows of. You might have a case where you are end up with a higher charge just because. And to me, those are two opposite problems of this bill, both the strict liability if it happens to be a political organization, and then two, the targeting of the motivation. And so I guess I have one more question on the motivation, but to me, not having a definition actually leads you to this question of, and maybe this is, you know, I was a public defender, so I have a healthy skepticism for prosecutors, but leaving to the discretion of the prosecutor, and, you know, I love them, I love prosecutors, but leaving to the discretion of the prosecutor, whoever they are, federal prosecutor, local law enforcement, I think that there's been critiques of that. The idea of how broad or narrow to interpret political, especially in this environment, feels like something we all, and particularly civil libertarians, should be concerned about. But given that it allows you to do that, any building that houses anything that is conceivably a political organization, that can potentially create a wide broth. And when it's up to the discretion of the prosecutor, sometimes it might get charged, sometimes it won't. But that, to me, feels like a haphazard way to treat something as precious, as I agree with you, as the First Amendment. So I guess my question is, how would you, if you agree with me that there's something there, how do you actually come up with a definition of political to cabin the discretion of how it gets charged and to make it more consistent, frankly? That's my question.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Greenman. I think that I think the task of trying to come up with a definition that would actually function in a manner that we would intend is something that transcends my ability to do here at this table in this moment. But thankfully, we are laying this over, and so I think that's something that can be worked on. And I also appreciate the point that's been made a couple of times by my colleagues on the other side of the aisle regarding this concept of kind of like an incidental charging of somebody who didn't have a political motivation, they just wanted to set a building on fire. So we can certainly work on trying to avoid that as being something where there's just kind of like a haphazard increase in penalty for no legitimate reason over the intent of what we're talking about here. What I will say, what encourages me about this conversation, and I'm glad we're having it, is I detect this kind of a Venn diagram from both sides of the aisle, where in the center of it, we're both concerned about people committing crimes for the purpose of suppressing other people's expression. This is how we're articulating it on our side. You've articulated it in a different way with hate speech, hate crimes. There's a nut in there somewhere. And I think it's a good exercise for us to try to figure out what that agreement is.
Representative Greenman?
Thank you. I appreciate that. And I think the definition piece, I think, really matters here in terms of, especially if we're talking about a criminal enhancement and enhanced criminal penalties. I guess the last thing I would say on the motivation piece is, and when we talk about the First Amendment, and I know we've talked about sort of your defense of the First Amendment and the idea of targeting motive, of actually sort of enhancing based on the motivation of the act. In this case, and as it relates to motivation, I think we need to be concerned about protecting the First Amendment rights of the victim for sure. And also protecting the First Amendment rights, not to do the act, right? We're not talking about arson is a crime, and it should be. And we should make sure our laws reflect the seriousness with which it causes all the damage that we both heard about today and all of the other times. But as we think about the First Amendment, right, the law doesn't just, and I don't think we believe it should, just protect the First Amendment speech in this very narrow way. And so the person committing the act, even if you can, and right, you should have to prove up that it's motivated, and that is a job for the prosecutors and the and juries and the defense system, or the criminal justice system. But I do think we have to be careful when we're talking about enhancements, about how to, where does that line of intent and motivation and the action that we're punishing begin. And that to me is, there's a couple of different First Amendment analyses, and I just want to make sure that we hold both of those when we consider bills like this.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Greenman. We're getting a whole lot more philosophical about this than I thought we would, but I'm glad, because these are important issues. And what I'll say is that the when we talk about the right to express yourself, the issue, once it crosses the line into some form of coercion, some form of offense, some form of tort, where you're actually violating the rights of another person, at that point, the First Amendment concern, in my view, is that you're attempting to chill the speech of not just that person, but anybody who agrees with them on whatever the point of contention is that you find so offensive. You're saying, this could happen to you too. We could come burn your place down if you agree with these guys over here. And whether these guys over here are Gender Justice or Center of the American Experiment or whoever they are, regardless of ideology, that is not something that I think we should tolerate. And it's a great conversation to continue going forward.
Representative Engen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a fascinating discussion. I want to talk and go a little bit more in depth on the First Amendment piece to this. We all know 1989, Texas v. Johnson, they affirmed that burning a U.S. flag is protected speech. Of course, we agree with that. I'm sure your side of the aisle agrees with that. Understood. But burning another person's flag is not protected speech. This is the property of another, and by doing so, like you've asserted, this is the chilling of another's speech. But by Representative Pinto's logic, it's an anti-First Amendment assertion that we have enhanced penalties for the purposeful defacing or destruction of a religious building or religious organization's property. And Title 18 of U.S. Code 247 has defined that as a hate crime, and that's been upheld. So to Representative Curran's point of your politics being a choice, well, you could make the exact same assertion of choosing a religion. So there's 100% validity in making this a separate crime based off of motivation. And currently, Minnesota does not have a definition in statute of religion. So therefore, you not having a definition of political organization is justified wholly. So I think this is well within the First Amendment. This is well within we're not chilling speech by doing this. We're saying others can't. So I appreciate your bill.
Representative Hudson responds.
Thank you, Representative Ingham. Thank you, Mr.
Representative
Chair.
Representative Johnson. Oh, I'm sorry.
No.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chair Novotny, Representative Hudson. This is exciting for me. This is like the first topic in the Public Safety Committee where we're not just talking about law enforcement or corrections. We get to talk about something I actually have a little bit of knowledge in. So I appreciate you bringing this forward. I think arson is different than porn in that I've been to a lot of fires where I've rolled up and not recognized it as arson, and it took a lot of hard work by our investigators over a long period of time to determine that it was potentially arson. So that having that definition to help aid them and help aid the county attorneys that would have to prosecute these types of things, having some type of clear definition so that it doesn't get labeled as a politically motivated action if it wasn't, right? And I agree with a lot of the discussion that's happening here that we don't want to use arson as a way to chill speech, if you will. So having some type of definition, we had a fire in Duluth a number of years ago where a synagogue got lit on fire. It was a huge fire, burned down a couple of our members, almost got killed. That rose to the federal level of a possible bias crime, hate crime, but because of they were able to determine that it wasn't, that the person was homeless and they were just trying to stay warm and they started a fire outside of a building in a corner, they weren't charged with those crimes. So that's where having a little clearer definition to give some guidance to the folks who are going to be trying these things, I think would be beneficial since this is being laid over. Encourage more conversations on what that looks like. And I appreciate also the conversations here about, you know, the chilling of speech and, you know, especially with what we're seeing nationally right now with the threats to withhold funding to chill actions or chill speech from different organizations and states. I'm super happy to hear so many folks are against the chilling of speech, both at, you know, the local individual level and on up. So I just wanted to offer a little bit of insight on that. Happy to have some conversations with you on what that definition looks like and connect you with some folks who are well-versed in the arson side of things. So thank you.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Johnson. And I very much appreciate you inadvertently making the argument for the next bill that we're about to hear regarding the difficulty of ascertaining the particulars of an arson crime. But as to the rest of it, and as has been said repeatedly, I'm very open to the idea of, look, you got a great idea of how we should define this. Let's do it, right? But the other thing that a point I'd like to make just since you brought it up is, you know, this, there is a distinction, and I think it's worth putting on the record, behind somebody committing a crime for the purpose of chilling speech and somebody deciding that they're not going to give you their money, whether that is an individual or publicly the government of any given jurisdiction deciding that they're not going to use taxpayer dollars in order to subsidize and endorse a particular form of speech. The freedom of speech is not an entitlement to be provided the means to speak.
Representative Schwartz, quick question before we go to Lee Moeller for the close.
Just a quick statement. Walter, I'm sorry. Thank you, Chair Nabati. Representative Hudson, I just wanted to thank you for bringing this bill to hearing today. I also wanted to thank the testifiers who came, Kendall Qual and Bill Walsh. I appreciate the work that you guys have done. Thank you for all the resources that you guys provide to us. Keep up the good work. What I've heard a lot in the last half hour is violation of the First Amendment, a freedom of speech. And unfortunately, Minnesota's statute 609-561 criminalizes the intention of destruction of dwelling in an occupied building by fire or explosion. The First Amendment protects freedom of speech, expression, assembly, and the right to petition the government, but it does not protect criminal acts, including arson. Now, you guys are saying, does this violate the First Amendment? No, it does not. While the First Amendment protects political speech, symbolic expression as a peaceful protest, it does not protect actions that cause harm to the people or property. Courts have already ruled on that. Thank you.
Lead Moore.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I will start by saying that as a prosecutor, I have worked on a couple of arson cases, particularly homicides. They are horrific. I think we can all agree on that. And I think what happened to the burnings of the centers mentioned here are also terrible. But I do have many concerns with this bill, as my colleagues have laid out over here. And I just need to make some things clear for the record. It is arson to commit a crime against on your own property. So to Representative Pinto's example of the T-shirt, you could buy the T-shirt to burn it to make a political statement. That would be arson. There could be a number of other examples. There are also constitutional violations, and I understand people are saying it doesn't violate the Constitution, but as we were sitting here listening to the testimony, I was reminded of a cross-burning case out of St. Paul from the 1990s. St. Paul had enacted an ordinance that made it a crime to burn a cross or swastika anywhere in an attempt to arouse anger or alarm on the basis of race, color, creed, or religion. Somebody had indeed burned a cross, and it went all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court, and Justice Scalia struck it down as unconstitutional under the First Amendment as content-based. There was also a concurrence in that case that said that the statute was unconstitutional under the First Amendment because it was overbroad. And we haven't really talked about that aspect of the Constitution here, and I think maybe what Representative Pinto, some of the questions he asked about, or maybe it was Rep. Greenman, about sort of the vagueness, and I think you said you wanted to leave it open for interpretation. Well, that leads to overbreadth and vagueness challenges also under the First Amendment, and I just want to make sure that that we're making that point as well. And then finally, and I think, you know, as you know, it takes 68 votes to pass a bill, and I know your testifier is going to be testifying on other bills today. I mean, it certainly isn't helpful when they come in here and hurl accusations at us in a way that is not helpful, but I do appreciate the back and forth conversation we have been able to have about the content of the bill. Thank you.
Representative Hudson, closing.
Very vigorous conversation. I appreciate it. I love these moments, and we've had them. We had them last term as well, where we get into a bill and we end up talking about some deep stuff. I remember the economic conversation, children, families, and there are other examples. This is one of those. The point I'll land on is just it's very important that we make a distinction between legitimate, constitutionally protected speech and expression versus actions which violate the rights of others. Very important that we do that. And once you take an action that violates the rights of others, suddenly your motivation becomes a factor. It's always a factor in the prosecution of those crimes. And so I don't think we're talking about something novel here, certainly not in the context of the conversations that we've had in the past regarding hate speech, hate crime. It's an ongoing national conversation about where those lines should be drawn. So again, I think where we're landing here is there's this kind of Venn diagram that I am not yet able to define, where there's something we're circling, there's something we're all orbiting, that it matters if your intention in committing a offense against somebody else is to keep them from being able to freely exercise their First Amendment rights. That's the heart of what this bill gets at, and I look forward to working with my colleagues on it, and I appreciate the conversation.
Thank you, Representative Hudson. With that, House File 767 is laid over. Representative Hudson, you can stay at the table. The next bill is also yours. Representative Hudson would like to move House File 764 before the committee. Since the fiscal note came back with zero cost, with the recommendation the bill is referred to the General Register. Is that your motion?
It is, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hudson, please explain your bill.
This one's a lot simpler. We are simply eliminating the statute of limitations for arson in the first degree. The current limitation is a period of 5 years. And as Representative Johnson pointed out, these cases do not always immediately or even in the foreseeable term result in identifying it, even whether it was arson, let alone who was responsible for it if it is. So what this would enable, and the other thing to point out is that in this particular case that we're talking about of the building that housed the three political organizations that were specifically targeted, to this date, a year later, we still don't know who the perpetrators were. And I don't think if we discover who they were and have the evidence to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that they were responsible for these crimes 5 years from now, and that's 1 year past this current statute of limitations, that should prevent us from seeking justice. That is my bill.
Representative Hudson, you have some testifiers. Could they?
I do. I'll call back up Kendall Qualls.
Mr. Qualls, could you please state your full name again?
And yes.
Understanding
Qualls.
That this is a highly emotional
sure.
thing for you to testify,
yep.
you've monitored the conversation.
Right. I thank the chair and I thank Representative Hudson. And let me first start off and just say I will be brief, but I want to convey and say to sincerely apologize to the committee for my heated rhetoric, my elevated rhetoric in the previous testimony. To provide context, currently in our new office, we have to keep that door permanently locked. I have young interns in that office. I have women that are there that won't go there alone because they're not sure what to expect because of what's happened. And although I get quarterly updates from the FBI that they have not been able to find the perpetrators, I have not heard one thing from our state law enforcement agencies. We haven't received a call or anything at the time of this happened from just other side, you know, representatives from the other side of the aisle. And I would suggest that at this point, moment in time when our country and our state so divided, examples of compassion, leadership, when times of crisis are like this are happening, is times for I think what people are looking for to see us come together. So again, my apologies for my earlier statement. I would recommend this bill only because the uncertainty of this crime and happening again just leaves people that have been victimized once to live with that victimization on an ongoing basis, not only just be their safety in the office, but having to take everything literally with them out of the office because of the extent of being damaged again like it was previously. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Qualls. Mr. Walsh? Once again, please state your full name and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bill Walsh, Senator of the American Experiment. I only have one thing to add. When the arson occurred, we had a $5,000 part of our insurance policy due to a reward fund for information leading to an arrest. We added $10,000 of our own to that, offered a $15,000 reward. And then after a month or so of nothing happening, we had a donor come forward and say that we should up the award. So there is an award fund out there for up to $100,000 if there's more than one. If there's $50,000, if we find one person convicted and arrested, another $50,000 if there's two people that committed the arson. So the reward fund's out there. I think the only hope for catching someone this late in the day is that reward is enough of an enticement for somebody to say, hey, you know, I know who did it, and I might come forward, and that's enough money to do it. So I think we appreciate the extension of the statute of limitation on this so that reward fund could do its job. Thank you.
Members, since it's very related to the last bill, I'm hoping that we can keep this to the actual bill. Questions? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Hudson, just a couple of things. Have you checked in with like some of the arson investigators or like the International Association, the chapter here in Minnesota, the International Association of Arson Investigators, on some of the implications of removing the statute of limitations at all?
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Johnson. I have not been very open to those conversations.
I just reached out. Oh, sorry, Chair. Representative, I had reached back out to just my department just to see what potential implications something like this would have. And while a lot of the issues that, you know, things that would be retained, you know, files or can be digitized, with fires like this, if they're going to have to retain all the evidence as well, that includes things from fire debris to appliances to couches, all these other things that are part of that arson investigation. And there would be some issues with keeping that stuff and keeping it in a way that it is usable for future cases. And for departments like ours or some of the bigger departments that go to a number of fires, it could create some real problems with retaining and doing something with that evidence and, you know, trying to keep it and maintain it into perpetuity. So question just is if there's any thought to how to possibly change this to allow for some of those things to be shed at certain points after, if it's determined to be arson, you know, to address some of those issues.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Johnson. I guess my question potentially for the other Mr. Johnson in the room, nonpartisan research, would be, is your reading of the text of this bill that it places any requirement upon investigatory agencies to maintain evidence for a certain period of time or for an indefinite period of time?
Mr. Johnson.
Chair Novotny, members, nothing in the bill explicitly requires that. I think that would be subject to the individual department as policy decisions.
Representative Johnson. Done?
Chair, no, I appreciate it. The other issue that could possibly come up is a lot of times when we, I kind of hit on this on the last one, but a lot of times when we go to a fire, based on the evidence that's there in front of us, it might be ruled undetermined or something like that, only to have something, you know, and then if that evidence or records hit that statute of limitations, gets dropped off, only for that later to be found out to be, it could potentially be arson. Is there any liability or anything that would come back on those departments or anything that you know of?
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Johnson. Not by my reading of the language of this bill, and I certainly would not intend that to be the case. I do not want to place a burden upon our investigatory agencies to potentially be liable for the disposition of evidence. This bill merely says that an investigation can be initiated and pursued at any point regarding an arson, whether it imposes no burden upon our investigatory agencies to retain evidence indefinitely.
Okay.
Good. Representative Ingett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is, I think, a very obvious bill. I think we should all get on board with it. If that five-year statute of limitations expires, an arsonist could knowingly joke about this, celebrate their action without having justice served in that case, similar to a state representative who was flaunting and celebrating the arson at Mr. Qualls and Mr. Walsh's building.
Ms.
So,
Elliott, could you keep it to the bill?
This is just wanted to make that point. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Elliott. Mr. Engen. Anyone else? Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't think I have anything super controversial to say on this one. I think we do need to be really careful about when we take away all statutes of limitations. I carried the bill to take away statute of limitations on sex crimes, in the past, and I caught some heat from that, both from my side of the aisle, other side of the aisle, from my own husband. He was like, why would you do that? And I think there's good reasons to do it, right? Like, the harm that comes from some of these acts lives on beyond the time period that we might think. And being able to find closure is important. And I don't know that I have a strong sense. I don't have anybody in my life who's experienced arson. And so I'm not gonna take a personal stance on this. But what I will say is we have to be really careful when we think about totally getting rid of statute of limitations, because it does end up being a burden on a system, right? And so just recognizing that, like, our systems are built of both policies, but also people who implement those policies. And so I think Representative Johnson's point is valid, that there is, like, some concern about what that means. And when you get rid of it, if you said extend it to 20 years, I might feel differently than just say get rid of it altogether, right? Because I feel like maybe there's some middle ground there. Anyhow, this is more of an offline conversation. As you can tell, I'm rambling. But I just want us to think about, when we do get rid of these things, if you're talking about indefinitely, that has a big implication for the systems that we work within.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Hollins. If you had brought that amendment, I would have given it serious consideration. And since, I mean, this is going to the General Register, is that correct?
That is correct.
Talk to me.
Representative Pinto is next.
I'll be quick, Chair. I want to build on that just to note, I mean, the reason we have statute of limitations is that we're balancing, right, holding people accountable for the things they've done and justice, but also finality. And the exceptions that we've made are quite limited when there's a death, a kidnapping, the criminal sexual conduct situation Representative Hollins described. There was a lot of groundwork laid to explain exactly why, what the reason was for that kind of crime. And, you know, there's the expression bad facts make bad law, and we want to be careful about legislating based on individual incidents. And I gather what I've heard is about this specific incident, not a very bad incident. And I understand the folks involved are seeking justice, as victims of crime are, and they should. But I guess I haven't heard specifically why this particular crime versus just let's sort of abolish all statute of limitations. Like, what is it about this crime that says that we should make an exception for that balance that we're striking? And it's not that I'm totally opposed, but I just haven't heard the justification beyond this particular incident. We want to make sure that if somebody is found at some point, we can go after them. And that doesn't seem like a good basis for policymaking.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Pinto. That's certainly a worthwhile question. And my sense of the answer is that while we have referenced this particular incident that took place last January, I see it as an incident that is indicative of a rising trend where, and this is something that I think has been recognized on both sides of the aisle, where folks feel empowered and justified in violating the rights of others in an attempt to impact the political discourse, the public discourse. And so sending the signal that this isn't something that you're going to be able to get away with, this is something that we are going to continue to pursue and try to seek and administer justice for, I think is an appropriate answer to that rising tide.
And the final point, Mr. Chair, is just, I mean, this will only apply after August 1st. I mean, this would not apply to the incident, unfortunately.
Correct.
Legally can't. Okay. Now, thank you, Chair. I'll be all done.
Lee Moore.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do think, just on that last point, the effective date is, if the statute of limitations period is still open, then it would be, it would perhaps apply. And I think those points are really well taken. When I saw this, I thought about some of the cases that, again, that I tried, and arson is a difficult case, my understanding, to prove. And so for me, that would be a more compelling reason, actually, to maybe extend the statute of limitations, just because those cases are difficult. We heard that with your testifiers and this example as well. And I do think Representative Hollins has a point of maybe it's not 5 years, but maybe it's not indefinitely. So hopefully we can have those discussions. And then to Representative Johnson's point as well, I think the fire marshal would be someone important to also consult with before this hits the floor. But I'm planning on voting yes to move it out of committee today. Thank you.
Well, Representative Hudson, we used to say investigations that if there's no real secret, if there was more than one person involved, eventually it'll come out. And having done arson investigations that, you know, did involve motivation and things, it'll come out eventually. So that being said, I'd like to know what's in the JFK file, so I don't like open-ended stuff either. Maybe we will put a time on this if that's okay. Representative Hudson, closing statement.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members, again for the conversation. My closing remarks are less about the bill itself and more just about what I'm observing in this process that we're engaging in here. One thing I've grown to appreciate about you, Lead Moeller, is your diligence when it comes to reaching out to stakeholders and asking, you know, who's this going to affect and making sure that they have a seat at the table in our policy conversations. And so more than happy to do that. And there, I think in recent days, we've seen plenty of examples of your side of the table bringing to light issues that need deeper digging. And I think that's what this process is for. So appreciate the conversation and ask for support of my bill.
Voice vote okay. Representative Hudson renews his motion that House File 764 is recommended to be re-referred to the General Register. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say nay. Motion carries. And House File 764 is re-referred to the General Register. Representative Hudson, we have one more left. Do you want to move House File 765 before the committee? The fiscal note came back with cost, so we will be laying the bill over for possible inclusion. Representative Hudson.
That is my motion, Mr. Chair. So House File 765 establishes mandatory prison sentences and aggravated durational departures and consecutive sentences for certain repeat offenders. So the idea here is that we have to, and we've had this robust conversation, I imagine we're about to have it yet here again in the Public Safety Committee, about the role that punitive measures properly ought to play in our criminal justice system. And the argument that this bill is making in its impact is that there is a point past which we have to accept that somebody has bad intentions towards their neighbors, towards society. Once you hit your third violent felony conviction, and each of those words are equally impactful, third violent felony conviction, maybe you need a timeout. Maybe you need to go sit in the corner and wear a dunce cap for a little bit. Think about what you did. That is the impact of this bill, and I'm hoping that I can get support from the members here today.
Representative Hudson, you have testifiers. Would they come to the table, please? Mr. Zimmer, state your full name and begin your testimony when you're ready.
Thank you, Chair Novotny and committee members. I'm David Zimmer, Public Safety Policy Fellow with Center of the American Experiment. I'm here today in support of House File 765, which seeks to ensure a more consequential criminal justice system by increasing the length of sentences and ensuring the imposition of mandatory minimum and consecutive sentencing for some chronic and violent offenders. Minnesota has been among the states with the lowest incarceration rates and the highest community supervision rates in the nation, and has been so for decades. Our incarceration rate currently stands at half the national average, and our weak sentencing and correctional policies are failing Minnesotans. While it is true our violent crime rate remains below the national average, it's not 50% lower. Minnesota has struggled with crime since 2020, while the nation has improved. Minnesota's violent crime rate remains 19% higher than it was in 2018. In Minneapolis, for example, the violent crime rate remains 41% higher than just in 2018. But during that same time, the national violent crime rate has decreased by 2.3%. Relevant to chronic and violent offenders, Minnesota is failing badly. According to our Sentencing Guidelines Commission data, we have seen a dramatic increase not only in the rate of felony cases sentenced, but also in the rate of repeat offenders being sentenced. Simply put, we've experienced an increase in crime, and the increase has involved far too many repeat offenders cycling through our revolving door of justice. Since 1981, Minnesota has experienced a 98% increase in the rate of felony cases sentenced. For person crimes, that rate has exploded by 180%. Between 1981 and 2022, the percentage of felony sentences involving defendants with no prior criminal history points dropped by 47%. During the same period, the percentage of felony sentences involving defendants with four or more criminal history points increased by an incredible 285%. So why aren't these chronic offenders incarcerated? Well, one significant reason is our judges continue to depart from presumptive prison commitments at record levels. By literally checking a box labeled amenable to probation, our judges can depart away from presumptive prison sentences as recommended by our sentencing guidelines. In 2023, the rate of those mitigated dispositional departures stood at 42%. In the same year, those same judges recorded a 0% aggravated or upward dispositional departure rate. The fact is, crime has increased in Minnesota over the years. However, our criminal justice system has failed to keep pace, and it has failed to establish a consequential response. Law-abiding Minnesotans are paying the price. House File 765 helps reestablish appropriate consequences for chronic and violent offenders, and I urge you to vote yes on this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Zimmer. Mr. Qualls? State your full name and begin your testimony.
Sure. Kendall Qualls, resident of Mendina. Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Hudson, for the invitation. I'd like to put this into context as a, again, a citizen resident of Minnesota. And just from a perspective of those that live in the community and how far we've come. In October 2009, Forbes magazine ranked the top 25 cities for their quality of life and the safest city in the country. Of those top 25 cities, Forbes ranked Minneapolis number one. Unfortunately, today it's not in that, right? And not even, I don't believe, in the top 25. And then what we have is in January 2nd of 2025 of this year, the Minnesota Reformer released a report, an article that noted that murders plummeted nationwide, but increased in Minneapolis. We have students, and actually I have a son that attends the University of Minnesota, the Carlson School, and a recent attempted carjacking happened with a student, not my son, but a different student, where a bullet went through his windshield for attempted carjacking. Don't know if that was a repeat offender, but I'm sharing this information to tell you how far we've dropped in recent years as a state and as a city. and I encourage you to consider this bill for passage. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you all for the invitation.
Thank you, Mr. Qualls. I don't believe there are any other testifiers signed up. Members, questions for Representative Hudson? Representative Feist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just looking online at statistics around crime in Minnesota, I just don't see, besides the Center for the American Experiment, I don't see other sources reporting similar data. I found this chart about violent crime in Minnesota. This is the 1960s, and it like went up in the 1980s, and then it's slowly been going down. We saw the pandemic, and that was obviously a really troubled time for our state and our country. But overall, those trends are pretty good. I found some data from Newsweek, so a national news outlet, that said that we're better off in terms of the violent crime rate than our surrounding states, except for North Dakota is slightly under Minnesota. But we're better than Wisconsin, South Dakota, Iowa. So I just question some of these statistics. I question it also with my life experience. I have a law firm that's in downtown Minneapolis, and I feel safe. So anyway, I just wanted to point out that I don't, you know, we should not legislate from a place of fear and hand waving. I think we really do need to look at the data. And, you know, we've had good conversations and, you know, we collectively have had good exchanges over the years about what is the goal of our public safety system, what are the goal of our laws. And, you know, one of those goals is to punish, but there are all sorts of goals. There's goals of rehabilitation because most of the people who are incarcerated are going to get out, and do we want them to get out and be law-abiding, like have a job, be able to support themselves. We also need to look at what people who have been a victim want. And that's not always just, you know, black and white punishment. And then just we have to think just, again, like following the data around what does protect public safety, what reduces recidivism. And, you know, I'm really excited about restorative justice. I had the honor of being the chief house author of the Veterans Restorative Justice Act my first term, and that's what got me on my kick. And sorry, Representative Mueller always laughs at me because I can't stop talking about restorative justice. But anyway, I just think there are a lot of considerations that we need to have when we're looking at increasing penalties, increasing incarceration. This bill is really focused on punishment, and I just want to look at these types of considerations with a bigger lens.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Feist. The old quote, and I don't know who said it originally, but, you know, lies, damn lies, and statistics, right? And that game is played on all sides of sorting through data in order to, with the preconceived intention of presenting a narrative. And I'm not accusing any of the folks who we've cited here today as being guilty of that, but it is something to take into consideration. I think at the heart of it, though, when we're talking about criminal justice, statistics can be important if they reflect accurate data, but it gets too impersonal. We're talking about people. We're talking about victims. We're talking about perpetrators. We're talking about human beings doing things to other human beings that should not be done. And what are we going to do about that? And again, what this bill says is that when you get your third violent felony conviction, we're done. Like, we're not playing anymore. Like, I past that point, I don't know if I care if you ever become a productive citizen, because you have opted out of productive society. Your third violent felony conviction? I don't know how interested I am in making sure you get educated and you get a, like, at that point, you're talking about a chronic dysfunction in a person's ability to be a member of society. And past that point, it is the responsibility of those of us who govern society to protect everyone else, to protect everyone who is functional, who isn't harming their neighbor, who isn't violating the rights of others. I'll give you some stats that I know are solid and that from a source that I know you trust. And I won't, you know, disclose the particulars of where I got this from, but I think you'll know when I tell you. I had a meeting this week with somebody who works with juveniles. And he presented me a folder that was about as thick as one of our statute books. The documents inside covered the crimes committed by only 6 juveniles. Those 6 juveniles, over the course of the last 18 months, are personally responsible for 174 separate victims. 174 separate human beings, real human beings, whose lives were touched in an inappropriate way by the actions of these kids. That's an average of 29 victims per kid. Now, at some point, our consideration properly should be the 174 as opposed to the 6, right? Like, all the concern of the current trajectory and momentum of our public safety conversation in the state seems to be upon the 6. What do we do about the perpetrators? What do we do to make their lives better? What do we do to put them on the right track? What about the 174 victims who somehow figured it out? They somehow have managed to go through their lives without hurting other people and stealing from other people and harming other people. We're just going to let their rights be violated because we're so deeply concerned about the folks who are perpetrating against them. And look, there is a middle ground. I know I'm getting a little heated because I care about it. There is a bullseye somewhere between the restorative practices and trying to get people back to where they need to be in order to be productive members of society and actually protecting the public from the terrible things that these people are doing. And I would like to think that providing an enhanced penalty for somebody who has 3 violent felony convictions hits right in that bullseye.
Representative Feist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We have 2 more bills to go.
Sorry, we're getting a little bit far afield, but I can't not respond. I'm not necessarily even saying that this bill isn't, you know, hitting that bullseye. I was more responding to the statistics which I thought were misleading. But I do think that you know now, having had that conversation, that those 6 kids were victims before they were offenders. And so I just need to point that out, that I think that we often approach our public safety in a really black and white way that isn't always the most effective in protecting public safety. So I'll just leave it at that. Thanks.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Feist. And sincerely, that is a valuable point and something we do need to continue to work on. There's a balance somewhere in there of, like, the 174 victims. Like, is it their responsibility to endure being victimized because somebody else was a victim? Is being a victim a justification or a rationale for victimizing someone else? I think we all agree it's not. Where compassion meets justice is an ongoing conversation, but I think this bill is a solid step when we say, once you've proven you're not interested in compassion, you get less of ours.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I'm just compelled, as the only member who serves and lives in Minneapolis, and it's been a while since there's been a Minneapolis member on public safety in the House, to just say, well, we're oftentimes the flogging horse of in most committees, and we're the biggest city, and we get it, but we should all be invested in the success. I'll say yesterday, there was a good news out of Minneapolis, and when we talk about the statistics, it's helpful to also talk about the good news. Tuesday, the city reported significant decreases in violent crime this year. 47% drops in robberies, 40% decreases in carjackings, 32% fewer shooting victims. Now, like, zero. Everywhere in the state, any shooting victim is too many. And that's also why we have to talk about gun violence and the flood of guns on our streets in Minneapolis. We talk about it. I hear about it all the time from constituents. And so I just will say it is very important that we are talking about, because if we're policymakers and we're talking about how our policies are impacting things, we are looking at both good news and bad news. But let's be clear, guns and shooting and violent crime, guns are as much a part of that as anything. And so having that conversation without talking about guns, to me, sort of doesn't address the problem. But as a Minneapolis member, now I am here to stand up for my city a little bit and say I hope we can all be invested in improvements and making sure all of those 500,000 people are safe from all of these things.
I didn't hear a question. Representative Hollins.
It's okay. It's okay.
Okay. Lead Moeller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I will be brief. I do have one question for Representative Hudson, and I'm curious if any victim advocacy groups have expressed support for this bill.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Moeller. I have not engaged with victim advocacy groups. Didn't feel as though it was necessary. This should be relatively non-controversial once you, again, have committed three violent felony, you've got convictions on three violent felonies. I don't know how much discussion is necessary to determine that that's somebody who should not be on our streets and able to victimize somebody else.
Lead Moore.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I just heard victims come up a number of times, and I would be curious to know how they feel, because I know in past years they have said increased penalties is not what they believe. This is the advocacy groups is the answer to solving crime. Victims aren't a monolith, so I'm sure you could find some victims who would be like, absolutely do this. But I do think it's still important, if you're going to say that victims want this, to at least talk to those advocacy groups and hear what their thoughts are around this and other possible solutions. I did just want to reference the sentencing guidelines, because those were referenced earlier as well. Since 1981, the number of felony cases sentenced annually has generally grown from 5,500 cases in 1981 to over 16,000 cases in 2023. And then I'm cutting down what I was going to say. In 2023, the total incarceration rate, the percentage of felony cases in which the sentence included prison or confinement in a local correctional facility, was 86% compared to 63% in 1982. And I think we could all agree on both sides of the aisle that what we have been doing isn't working, and I think we need other solutions. I think we need prevention. We need rehabilitation. We definitely need people to be held accountable to, and I'd love to continue working on solutions for all of those things. I just don't think this bill hits the mark.
You want to respond to that before I ask the last question and you close, or?
I think I can respond to it in my close. Go ahead and ask your question.
All right. Representative Hudson, I agree what we've been doing isn't working, and that's why we work together on this bill. Maybe you haven't had a chance to talk to victims directly, but I've been with you on the corner 36th and Penn when you did talk to victims and you did have this conversation, if I could remind you about that conversation that we had. And I'll remind you, and we've been not to assault or kick a city that it's down, but one day we picked and we went to 36 and Penn and met with people. And when we got there, they were just taking down the crime seat, the crime tape from one end of the next block over. They were taking down the crime scene tape from a murder that happened there. And we met with some people on the corner. And before I got home or to my next event, which was actually a fundraiser for Jamal Mitchell in St. Paul, in the time it took me to drive from there to St. Paul, there had been another murder, not 50, maybe 75 feet away from where we had been standing. So we're not trying to pick on any particular place, but in my career in 30 years in Sherburne County, had there been two murders within a block in the course of about 4 hours, we would take that very seriously, and there would be changes if it was in Sherburne County or North Oaks or Maplewood. My question for you is, isn't it true that this bill already exists? It's been on the books we're changing some technical language in the bill, but you know, your bill would change the statute to basically go from may to must. The guts of the bill is one word, and there's some stuff that follows through it, but it's made a must because a long time ago, someone sat probably in this room, went, took a vote on the floor, and the governor signed it thinking that this was a good idea. And I don't know, we don't have the statistics, but if it gets to the floor, something that if you could have ready for me, because I'll ask you this question again when it comes to the floor, is how many times has the current statutes been followed? And I don't expect to have you to have that answer right now, but Representative Hudson closing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and once again, thank you, members, for the vigorous conversation. I know, Representative Greenman, your comments did not include a question, but I do want to show a little bit of love for Minneapolis. Like, I dig Minneapolis. I worked there for many, many years. I worked at Fairview Riverside. I worked at University of St. Thomas. I worked at Minneapolis College of Art and Design. And I played in Minneapolis, and I had fun in Minneapolis for many, many years. I used to take my kids Macy's downtown, used to have a Santa Land. It was something we looked forward to every year. We would get on the North Star Line. We would have a heavily subsidized trip down to downtown Minneapolis to go see Santa Claus, and it was a lot of fun. What I will tell you is that in talking to the people who live around 36th and Penn and talking to the organizations who serve them, what I hear time and time again is that there needs to be this bullseye that I'm talking about. It can't just be the services. There also has to be accountability, and not accountability in this vague, you know, let's sit around and talk until you admit what you did type of accountability, but actual punishment as justice administered for the offense you made against another person. And this bill speaks to people who three times it has been proven beyond a reasonable doubt that they committed violent felonies against their neighbors. That is worthy of the, as Chair Novotny points out, language of existing statute actually being applied to their sentencing so that we get them off the street. And you know what? After you've been sitting around for a few years, maybe you'll be open to the idea of becoming a better person. And then we can talk about the programming that we're going to implement in order to make that happen. But the programming doesn't work. And another piece of feedback I got from my conversation this week in speaking to somebody who deals with juveniles is the programming's fantastic, but you got to have them in the room. Like, you have to have them, have hold of them in order to have the programming happen. If they can just get up and leave, if they don't care, if they don't want the help, then it's not going to impact anything. And the cumulative effect of the current, this current trend of just continually letting people go and assuming they want to be good people and thinking that it's just that they've been underserved and that's the only reason why they're engaging in crime. When we talk about these statistics, again, lies, damn lies and statistics, I think a lot of what's happening is people aren't reporting crimes. They're just laying down and letting themselves be victimized because they know, just like the criminals know, that nothing's going to be done about it. What's the point of calling the cops? The person's going to be out tonight. How many stories have we heard in this committee room from law enforcement saying, yeah, we pick up kids and they know they're going to be out the next day? So this is a common sense bill. I appreciate the conversation and I ask for your support.
With that, House File 765 is laid over. Thank you, Representative Hudson. Feel free to stand up and stretch your legs while Vice Chair Witte has the next bill on the agenda, House File 1401. This will be your bill. Please come forward with your testifiers. Since you are a member of the committee, would you like to move House File 1401 before the committee? And since the fiscal note comes back with no cost, the recommendation is we refer to the general register.
Yes.
Representative Witte, when you are ready, please begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Novotny. Thank you, fellow Public Safety Committee members. House File Number 1401 expands the definition of endangered for the person or for the purpose of the Missing Endangered Persons Program. This is a result of great work with Superintendent Evans a couple years ago to refine the concept of a silver alert system for persons with Alzheimer's, dementia, or TBIs into one of the adding people with these conditions into the current Missing or Endangered Persons Program. We all have heard the stories of a loved one being missing due to one of these conditions, and these will go out to law enforcement as an alert and allow them to use the tools able to locate someone's loved one or missing person that's going through one of these terrible incidents. And my testifier, Representative Zelenskar, when I told her about this bill, has worked in the area and wanted to talk about it.
Representative Zelenskar. Go ahead.
Oh, gosh. It's been a long day. Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Woody. I just come, members, to speak on behalf of seniors and this disease that happens, and it can change fast in for family members and for aging people. And Minnesota has a very large aging population right now. It literally just this week, being down here, I saw it on the news, somebody missing, and I thought about this bill and how important this bill is to have clarification on this specific disease and how it affects seniors, because time is of the essence, and whether or not people, wherever they live, in caring for seniors in assisted living and nursing homes for over 40 years, I saw this happen many times. I mean, they follow the mailman out. The fire trucks come when somebody falls, and they're by the door, and there can just be one single thing that happens, and you have a missing person, and or somebody lives at home and they're not supposed to drive, or something has changed and they're missing. And so this bill really gives clarity for public safety and allows timeliness, which is really critical to try to find people as soon as we know that they truly are missing. So thank you for bringing this bill, Rep. Woody.
Representative Woody, anything else?
Thank you, Chair Novotny. There's some information about the endangered missing person alert information for law enforcement, some of the guidelines that are as follows. There's a letter of support from MPPOA, and also the Sheriff's Association is supportive of it. And we do have bipartisan support on this, so I just appreciate your support.
Speaking of bipartisan support, Representative Feist, I know that this is something you've been active in. Do you have any questions for?
Thank you so much, Chair Novotny. Yes, I actually just emailed to sign on as a co-author because I intended to. Seniors in my community really support this. I think it's a really good idea, and I'm glad that you introduced this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Lead Moeller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We had too much praise, Representative Witte, yesterday. I guess it's coming back again today. But appreciate this bill and am glad to support it. Thank you.
All right. Vice Chair Witte, would you like to close?
Thank you guys all for your support again.
Vice Chair Witte renews his motion that House File 1401 is recommended to be re-referred to the General Register. All in favor of this motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, nay. Motion carries and House File 1401 is referred to the General Register. Lead Mueller, are you willing to go over by a couple of minutes? Lead Mueller, as you come to the chair, you are a member of the committee, so we'll have lead House File 1354. This is your bill. I see that you're up there with your testifiers. Since you are a member of the committee, would you like to move House File 1354 before the committee with a recommendation it is re-referred to Judiciary?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That is my motion.
Lead Mueller, please begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you so much for having a hearing on this bill. I very much appreciate it. So currently the BCA is required to post to its website all public data from officer-involved death investigations within 30 days of the end of the appeals period. And what's happening is, and Superintendent Evans will be able to speak to this, there are a lot of videos. And I know from prosecuting cases that crimes that, you know, didn't used to exist in a video world, now there are videos everywhere. And there's a lot of information to sift through, and often a lot of people who are just bystanders and not even part of the case that may need to be redacted out. And so the purpose of this bill is to make sure that the BCA is still posting that important information, but narrowing so that it's not every single video that's out there, but it's really targeted to what we were trying to do when this legislation passed. And with that, I'll turn it over to my testifier.
Superintendent Evans, please begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Novotny and Lead Mulder, for bringing this bill for us. I really appreciate the hearing on this today. What this has already been referenced is that we are required in our, you know, primarily officer-involved shooting investigations, but officer-involved death investigations, to post the entire file and all the information on the BCA's public website. This came from a lot of scrutiny around these cases in our state, and putting all of the information in one place so that the public can consume that and be able to download that information. We still, we want to meet that 30-day turnaround time, and as Lee Moeller noted, with the challenges that we've had is in particular body cam. The body cam statute in Minnesota drives and the information that needs to be posted, but because of the way that statute is constructed, there's a lot of private data on there. And what that means is we have to redact the data that didn't capture the incident itself or even what led up to it or the immediate aftermath of oftentimes, and there's examples that I could provide where, say, a large police department, there could be 30, 60 police officers that respond after the fact, providing scene security, still have body cams activated, and we have to go through and redact that real time, and it's extremely time intensive. What this bill does is it doesn't change the data classification of any of the information. If a request were to be made for that information, we will still do that. We will just put it in our normal data practices queue based upon requests. But the goal of this is to get the information most of most interest to the public as quickly as possible, which, as we know from these investigations, really is the incident itself and what led up to the incident, so that we meet that 30-day turnaround time. We have a team of 9 people that do only data practices requests at the BCA now, so a full-time team doing this, and we cannot keep up right now and meet that 30-day turnaround time. So again, this doesn't change any data classification. It's simply, and we will still put everything else up that we normally would, including the video that captures the incident and what led up to it. It would simply be what we refer to, which doesn't read well in a bill, extraneous video, meaning other video that doesn't actually pertinent to the incident itself. So happy to stand for any questions or explain further, Chair. This is simply a goal to make sure we put the most pertinent information on the website as quickly as possible.
Questions for Lead Mulder or Superintendent Evans? Lead Mulder, close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate your support, committee.
Lead Mulder renews her motion that House File 1354 is recommended to be re-referred to Judiciary. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion carries. House File 1354 is re-referred to Judiciary. Almost got me. Thank you, Lead Mulder, and your testifiers. Our next committee will be Tuesday, March 11th at 3 p.m., and for anyone watching, the after is canceled. There being no further business before the committee, this meeting is adjourned.